Jonathan, thank you very much. I value this opportunity to take part this morning in your Pulver.com conference, Freedom to Connect 2006. And as Jonathan was indicating, your timing is exquisite because we are beginning today what will be a several-day process to consider telecom legislation. It is a comprehensive bill. I'm going to talk about its major components, some of which I will tell you I strongly support, others of which I fear have major shortcomings. And the biggest potential problem is the net neutrality language, which, as far as I'm concerned, is actually a net minus from the status quo. And we need to address this, and we hope to do it in a positive way. Let me talk a little bit about process first, since Jonathan opened that subject. We do begin this afternoon in our telecom subcommittee with a series of opening statements on the bill. This will simply be a time when members can set forth their basic views about the contents of the bill, and in some cases, members will talk about amendments they intend to offer when the amending session, we call that a markup, begins tomorrow. That will take place starting at 10 in the morning and will continue at least all day and perhaps into Thursday. There will be a lot of amendments offered. We don't know how many yet. In fact, I was on the BlackBerry with my staff on the drive over here this morning. You'll be pleased to know I wasn't driving while I was doing that, but I was BlackBerrying her about the amendments that we intend to offer, and we're still in the process of refining those and deciding among the various opportunities which we, in fact, will offer. I'm sure that other members of the subcommittee are doing the same. So we don't know how many amendments in total will be offered. We don't know how long this will last. In terms of actually viewing the markup, I would offer this advice. It's going to be hard to get into the room itself. As a matter of fact, there is an institution on Capitol Hill called line standing. I don't know if you are familiar with that, but graduate students, well, actually, it's probably not graduate students, but people who are in maybe the early years of college, or some people who may have dropped out of college, some who may not have gone at all, hire themselves out to trade associations in order to stand in line for seats in the committee room, which is quite small. The committee room actually seats less people than this movie theater. And so for a markup session on a bill that has lots of interested external stakeholders, as this one certainly does, the demand for those seats is quite large. The number of seats is limited. So people literally, for a day ahead of time, stand in line, and the Capitol Police start a line somewhere outside the Rayburn House office building where this hearing room is. And if you drive around the Capitol complex, you'll see these lines periodically of people sitting there. Some of them have sleeping bags, and they're there to stay all night in order to hold a place for whoever the trade association representative is going to be that's going to sit in the room the next day. It's a lousy system. Frankly, I wish we had more room in the House. We really don't have a large hearing room, not anywhere in the Capitol complex. The Senate does a bit better. They do have, in the new Ford Senate office building, at least one large hearing room. We don't, and so we're relegated to this process, which I think is kind of embarrassing for all parties concerned. The good news is we have a webcast that is available now from virtually all of the hearing rooms in the Capitol. And if you want to watch what we're doing, it's available on the webcast. All right, that's how you can actually watch this if you're interested. When our subcommittee processes this bill and finishes its work this week, it moves to the full Committee on Energy and Commerce, probably the first week that we're back from our two-week recess, which begins on Friday. We will take up that bill in full committee, with the prospect that it will be on the floor of the House by the first week of April, or perhaps, I'm sorry, the first week of May, or perhaps the second week of May. So by the middle of May, in all likelihood, this measure will have been debated and passed in the House. The Senate is on a somewhat different track and will be adding some additional elements, and I'll comment just a bit upon Senate process as I conclude these remarks. Let me talk a bit about the substance of this bill. Here are the things that it's doing in the main. First of all, it creates a national franchise for multi-channel video providers that are seeking to enter the cable TV market as competitors. First on for this will be the telephone companies that are now seeking to offer multi-channel video throughout their service territories. In a major way for telephone companies, this is a have-to case. Cable is well positioned with its coaxial infrastructure going into homes to carry three valued services. It can carry cable TV, which it's been doing historically. It can carry broadband internet access, which it's been doing somewhat more recently. And it can also offer telephony, which it's been doing much more recently. And the infrastructure is largely in place for cable companies to do that. It's a tougher lift for telephone companies to do the same thing and compete with that bundle of three services, which consumers increasingly want to have. Telephone companies can offer broadband with DSL, but at slower speeds than the cable modem service typically. They obviously have for a long time offered telephony, but they're really stretched when the occasion calls for them to offer multi-channel video. The twisted pairs of copper wires can carry some channels, but not the hundreds of channels that reside in the cable set-top box, typically, inside the residence. And so new technologies have to be devised, and IP video is now being experimented with by some of the major companies as a means of using those twisted pairs of copper wires that go into the home in order to offer cable television. Using video switching with the content residing further down the network in a central office somewhere within the community, they now have what looks like a realistic solution in order to offer several channels at once with rapid switching among the various offerings they have. So from the consumer standpoint, it is pretty seamless, and it seems a lot like the cable TV experience with potentially even better quality. So from a technical standpoint, they've probably found a solution, and Verizon is sort of the outlier on this and is going all the way with a fiber to the home project where they have committed over a period of time to deploy fiber into every home and business they serve across the nation. Frankly, I wish all the telephone companies would do that. Building out that infrastructure would carry a lot of positive social consequence and economic consequence beyond just helping that individual company in its competition with cable. So I think Verizon is doing the right thing. And it's not going to have capacity constraints the way that the other companies that are using these hybrid solutions of fiber into the neighborhood and then twisted pairs of copper into the home are going to experience. All of them, however, whatever their technical solution, face a common problem. And that is that for Verizon, for example, there are 10,000 local franchising authorities in its service territory. And so as the law now stands, for Verizon to offer multi-channel video to all of its subscribers, it would have to get 10,000 local government-issued franchises. And Verizon had been trying for years to get franchises. I think for about 2 years, they had an effort underway to do it, and they were averaging something like 15 franchises a year that they were able to negotiate and conclude. At that rate, obviously they wouldn't have gotten into offering this service in a meaningful way for a very long time. And so a change is necessary, and I support this change. I think there's a broad consensus that this change should occur. And so the primary purpose of the bill that we will begin considering this afternoon is to create a national one-stop shop for franchising. Under the terms of this bill, telephone companies and others that want to get into the multi-channel video business can simply go to the Federal Communications Commission and file an application. And upon filing that application, they will be agreeing to abide by a certain set of rules. And I'll mention these rules to you. And once they have agreed to that and filed their application, they have a legal right at that point to begin offering multi-channel video anywhere that they seek to provide that service. Now, here are the rules they have to follow. They will have to pay a 6% franchise fee to the local government. That actually is 1% more typically than what cable is paying as a franchise fee in most of the communities around the country. So this is 6% of the gross revenue obtained from the multi-channel video service that would be paid to the local government. Secondly, they will have to carry the same public access and educational channels that the incumbent cable provider is required to carry. Third, they will have to abide by whatever right-of-way requirements apply to cable within that particular community. So they will not get any special concessions in terms of right-of-way. They will follow the same rules. They will have to abide by a set of consumer protection requirements that the Federal Communications Commission will promulgate. And this will be a new rulemaking the FCC will undertake as directed in this bill to set consumer protection requirements for multi-channel video nationwide. Cable, the incumbent provider, will get the benefit of this one-stop-shop national franchise at such point as its existing franchise in the community expires, assuming that when that event occurs, there is a wired competitor in that community. Satellite doesn't count, but if a wired competitor comes in, or perhaps a fixed wireless competitor, someone, in other words, who's offering local service in that community directed toward that community, then cable, the incumbent provider, would be able to take advantage of this national video franchise as well. The bill says that the provider may not redline. In other words, once you elect to serve a community, you can't decide that you're only going to serve the rich parts of the community. You basically can't discriminate based on income levels or race or other objective criteria such as that. On the other hand, this bill does not contain a build-out requirement. In other words, it doesn't say that within a certain number of years, the new provider would have to serve the entire community, the entire cable franchise service area that it has elected to serve. This part of the measure is largely non-controversial with one exception, and that is on the build-out requirement. And I think you will see a spirited debate with John Dingell, the ranking member, the ranking Democrat on the subcommittee and on the full committee, offering an amendment that would require build-out. And I don't know how that's going to come out. I think it will be a closely divided vote. A second major provision of this bill I also strongly support, and that is a provision that will clearly open the door for local governments around the country to provide broadband services. The United States, yes, I thought a few people here might like that. The United States at the present time is 16th in the world.
Lower. 20th.
We're 20th now? All right, well, that information is a month or so out of date. So we're now 20th in the world. That's sad news. I'm sorry to hear that. 20th in the world in broadband deployment, measured as the percent of the population that is using broadband. Mm-hmm. And that is a disgrace. 16th was a disgrace. 20th is worse. And we have got to address this. We're the country, after all, that invented the Internet. There's a bit of a debate about who did that within the country, but we unequivocally are the nation where the Internet was invented. We still are the place where the most popular Internet applications are created, and we ought to be doing a lot better. It's a tragedy in a way that not only do we have a lower percent of our population subscribing to broadband, but the broadband they subscribe to is substantially slower than in other countries. In Japan and Korea, 100 megabits per second is more or less the standard. Here, you're lucky if you get a megabit per second. And you pay more for the megabit per second than people in Japan or Korea pay for 100 megabits per second. So we are way behind. Now, there are a lot of things I think we need to do in order to catch up, and I could give you another talk on that another day, but one thing that we can do that I think will make a significant difference and help in this is opening the doors for local governments to offer commercial telecommunication services for their residents. Some states have prohibited that by statute. I don't know how many, but it's not an insubstantial number. Other states have restrictions in place that, in effect, disallow the offering of the service because those terms are so onerous. And the Supreme Court decided to take a pass on this. The Supreme Court could have interpreted a provision that we passed as a part of our 1996 Telecommunications Act to enable local governments across the country to offer the service. We simply said in that law that states could not prohibit any entity from offering commercial telecom services. And states that had sought to bar this practice tried to get an interpretation by the Supreme Court that the word entity did not include local governments. Believe it or not, the Supreme Court agreed with that and essentially said that entity, the broadest possible term we could think of to use, the most inclusive possible term, didn't apply to local governments. Why? Well, in the rationale of the Supreme Court, local governments are creatures of the state. They are created by the state, therefore they are not separate entities when viewed from the perspective of state governments. And so the Supreme Court sided with the states that had sought to bar the offering of commercial telecom services by local governments within their state. That meant that every state was free to set its own rules, and some states, as I indicated, have decided to bar local governments from this market altogether. We're going to reverse that statutorily. We're going to say that no state may prohibit a local government entity within its borders from offering commercial telecom services, nor may it pass a law that has the effect of prohibition. In other words, it can't be a set of restrictions so onerous as in practicality to bar the offering of that service. And this is a huge step forward. We are, I think, on the brink of a major opportunity with regard to expanding broadband in smaller communities and in rural areas. And that comes by virtue of a new generation of wireless technology that is lower cost and far more efficient than the older generations of Wi-Fi. And I'm referring to mesh networks. And I was pleased to see that Tropos is one of the sponsors of this conference. Tropos has led the way in introducing mesh networking technology, which creates an opportunity for the public works department in a locality to actually install these transmitter receiver devices on just about anything that has elevation, a telephone pole or an electric utility pole or a church tower, and then cover a part of a community with broadband. And because these nodes interact with each other wirelessly, and everyone does not have to be physically connected to a wire that leads back to a central office or to an internet connection, each one of these nodes then becomes a point from which the network can be expanded further. And so this creates a far more efficient and lower cost way of putting broadband into place, even in a small, financially unfortunate rural community, than anything we've seen before. And I think it is a tremendous step forward, and it does offer a broad opportunity for us to maybe move back into 16th, if not better, in the world standing. So, you know, it's not the total answer, but it is a part of the answer, and it's a big step forward. And I am very glad that we have now got this provision within the bill, and I'm pleased to tell you it's non-controversial. We asked some questions about it in the hearing last week, just to see if anybody planned to oppose it. No one does. And so one thing I can predict to you with confidence is that if this bill becomes law, and I think the chances of some version of the overall bill passing are quite good, we will then open the door for local governments to offer this service. Now, that's the good news. The less than good news is the final subject I want to address today, and really the most important that I will address to you, and that is the question of network neutrality. The Federal Communications Commission, under Chairman Michael Powell, issued a set of network neutrality principles. These were principles only. They never were reduced to a formal rulemaking at the FCC. And what I mean by that is that they were never given the force of law. In part, I think, in large part, because I believe the FCC was concerned that it did not have adequate statutory authority to adopt these network neutrality principles. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia has kept the FCC on a very short leash when it comes to the question of the adequacy of its statutory authorities. There are many cases going back over a period of 15 years or so where the D.C. Circuit has invalidated FCC orders on the ground that the FCC didn't have the authority to issue those. And so the FCC in this case, I think, sensing some statutory inadequacy here, decided not to go forward and turn these principles into a rulemaking. So today, they are only principles. They do not have the force of law. These principles are fine as far as they go, but they don't go far enough. Here are the four principles. First of all, that consumers may access any content over the internet. So, read literally, what this would mean is that a transport provider who has market power in the last mile, you read that as a cable company or a telephone company offering either DSL or cable modem service, may not block access to websites that its customers may design to access, nor may it limit the content on those websites that its customers are receiving. Now, all of this is subject to the ability to guard against spam and to operate the network in a manner that assures that it is secure. But with those exceptions, the broadband provider may not block access to content nor discriminate against content. The second principle is that the consumer may run applications of his or her choice using the network in order to do that. That means you can download whatever software you want to and utilize that software. All of these, by the way, are also subject to the limitation that, you know, what you're downloading has to be lawful content. I mean, there are some permissible controls that can be put in place for unlawful content. The third principle is that you can connect devices to the network. Whatever device you want to use that does not harm the network, you are able to connect. And the fourth principle is that every consumer is entitled to competition among network providers, service and application providers, and content providers. And so the broadband provider that connects that customer to the internet can't operate the internet in such a way so as to limit that competition. Now, these are broadly stated principles. We have not actually seen applications of these principles beyond one case. And that one case was the Madison River case that you may be familiar with, where Madison River, a small telephone company, sought to block the Vonage port to prohibit voice over internet protocol delivered by Vonage from being accessed by the small telephone company's customers. This was about as blatant an action as one can imagine in violation of the most basic network neutrality principle. That case went to the FCC. Now, because these principles did not have the force of law, the FCC did not have the authority to enter a direct order without the consent of all of the parties to the proceeding. But Madison River, I think, sensing weakness in its position, agreed to the entry of a consent order at the FCC that said that it would not block the port in the future. Now, what that basically says in terms of precedent is not very much, because it was a consent decree. The FCC did not have full legal authority to order Madison River to stop that. And so even in this most obvious instance, the FCC under current law is kind of powerless to act unless it can persuade the bad actor to adopt a different course, which it was able to do in that case. So obviously we need to do some things to address network neutrality just in terms of these four principles, which I think we all would agree are a pretty good start, although not clearly not enough. What the bill that is before us will do is essentially say that the FCC may enforce these four principles. It gives the FCC statutory authority to have what we call a complaint process. And that means that if we had another Madison River case or some other factual circumstance where one of these principles or some number of them were violated, the aggrieved party could come to the FCC and file a complaint, and the FCC would have the authority under this bill to issue orders. So it could do as a matter of law what it had to do as a matter of persuasion in the Madison River case. Now that's a step forward. There is no authority for a rulemaking, however, so the commission could not elaborate on these principles. The commission could only take the principles as originally announced under Chairman Powell, and then enforce them when a complaint is received. They can't expand on them by issuing a rule. The big problem here is that at the time Chairman Powell was at the FCC, and up until very recently, we were not aware of what now is obviously going to be a major new business model. And that new business model is the announced plan by some of the large telephone companies to derive another revenue stream using the internet and their dominance within the last mile in order to do it. And that new revenue stream is going to be charging edge providers, content providers like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft when it offers its applications and services, a fee. And that fee will entitle that edge provider, that content provider out on the internet to get fast lane treatment, high speed access delivered over the broadband pipe into the home. Everybody else is going to wind up getting regular speed into the home. And so what the telephone companies are essentially proposing is a two-lane internet that goes into the home over their last mile pipe. And they're going to have a fast lane. Their own content will go in that fast lane. And also in that fast lane will be the content of any content provider who pays for the privilege of getting fast lane access. Everybody else is going to be relegated to the slow lane. Now, what's the major problem with this? Here's the major problem, as I see it, and maybe you can suggest some other major problems too. But the major one I see is that there could be a dramatic adverse effect on innovation. It wasn't very long ago that Google was in a garage getting started. And today there are Google wannabes in a garage somewhere getting started. And how is that Google wannabe that's in a garage getting started today going to be able to pay every last mile provider in the country a fee to get into every potential customer's home? The answer is obviously they can't. These are companies that have to give their services away for a long time in order to become established. And they're simply not going to be able to pay this toll in order to have fast lane access on the internet. And in the slow lane, they're not going to be able to compete. Latency matters in these instances. And a lot of consumers are simply not going to be interested in waiting to access a service in the slow lane when they've got the established Google or Yahoo there in the fast lane coming to them with lightning speed. And so the effect on innovation could be real. Admittedly, it's something of an unknowable. We're talking about the future here. We don't know how this will work in practice, but I have deep concerns that it will work to the disadvantage of young innovators in this country. It may be harder for them to acquire capital to start up. They may be sufficiently discouraged that they'll do something else rather than start an internet business that could grow into the next Yahoo or Google. So it's a major problem. Some would say, I mean, when I've raised these arguments, some of the response that comes from the telephone companies is, well, I mean, once you get by their superficial arguments, they then say, well, let's just wait and see how the market develops. Let's see how this all works out. Here's the problem. We don't have an opportunity. We don't have the luxury to sit back and wait and see how all of this works out. Experience teaches us that once revenue is being derived by a business from a particular business model, it is virtually impossible to outlaw the business model. You simply can't come back and do that years later. If telephone companies 5 years from now are deriving billions of dollars in revenues from this toll gate apparatus they put in place and charging internet providers, service and application providers fees to get into that fast lane, and we see that innovation is dampened and we can measure that effect and actually make the case with real numbers instead of hypothetical arguments, which is what we're having to do now, it's going to be too late to act. We're not going to be able at that point to take away a business from which the telephone companies are deriving billions in revenues. I know that as certainly as I stand here. But what you're going to hear if you watch our markup and you listen to the debate on network neutrality is the defenders against our amendment that would provide real network neutrality say, let's just sit back and wait and see how the market develops, and if a problem arises, we'll address it in due course. We don't have the luxury of doing that. I think we have a one-shot opportunity to do it now, and we absolutely must. So you're going to see an amendment offered. It will be offered by four of us. I'm going to be joined in this by Ed Markey, who is the ranking Democrat on the Telecom Subcommittee. Other co-sponsors are going to be Jay Inslee from Washington State and Anna Eshoo from Silicon Valley. We're all Democrats. I think we're going to have some Republican support for this amendment. I hope so. If it's going to have any chance of passing, we have to have. They have the majority. They may not this time next year, but they have the majority now. But I think it's going to be a close vote. This is the critical debate that we're having in telecom legislation this year. It is this net neutrality principle. What we're going to offer it, in short, is an amendment that says that if a telephone company or a broadband provider of any kind decides to prioritize any content, meaning if they give fast lane treatment to any content, whether it's their own or someone else's, then they have to offer that same fast lane treatment to all content providers without charge. So if you create a fast lane, you have to give everyone access to it without charge. I think that is a valuable addition to these network neutrality principles, and it is by far at this point the single most important one, in my view. Don't know how that debate's going to come out, but we are determined to do what we can.